Welcome to episode 91 of the Selling Your Screenplay podcast. I'm Ashley Scott Myers, screenwriter and blogger over at sellingyourscreenplay.com. Today, I'm talking with screenwriting career coach Lee Jessup. We talk about her book and we talk through a variety of career strategies for screenwriters at various stages of their careers. So there's lots of great information for screenwriters, no matter what level you're at. So stay tuned for that. If you find this episode valuable, please help me out by giving me a review in iTunes or leaving a comment on YouTube or retweeting the podcast on Twitter or liking us on Facebook. These social media shares really do help spread word about the podcast, so they're very much appreciated. A couple of quick notes. Any websites or links that I mention in the podcast can be found on my blog in the show notes. I also publish a transcript with every episode in case you'd rather read the show or look at something later on. You can find all the podcast show notes at www.sellingyourscreenplay.com/podcasts, and then just look for episode number 91. I just want to mention, too, a free webinar that I'm doing on Wednesday, September 30th. I'm basically redoing the webinar I did in August. I had a lot of people who weren't able to attend, so I'm going to do the exact same webinar again live. It's called How to Effectively Market Your Screenplay and Sell It. I'm going to go through all the various online channels that are available to screenwriters and give you my unfiltered opinion of them. I get questions all the time like, does the blacklist work? Does Inktip work? Or which contests should I enter? I've tried pretty much every marketing channel available to screenwriters, and I'm going to give you my unfiltered opinion on each one and tell you which ones have worked for me. Again, this webinar is completely free. Don't worry if you can't make it to the live event. I'll be recording this event so you can sign up. And then if you sign up but can't attend the event, I will send out a link so that you can listen to the event later on at your leisure. To sign up, just go to sellingyourscreenplay.com/free webinar. And free webinar is all lowercase and all one word. I will, of course, link to the webinar in the show notes. So if you can't remember that, just check out episode number 91 of the podcast on Selling Your Screenplay. A quick few words about what I'm working on. So last week, I've been very busy rewriting the project I wrote the previous week. I mentioned that last week that I wrote this script in a week. Well, now I'm going through and doing rewrites on it. I got onto the set where they're going to be shooting. This was valuable as it allowed me to go back into the script. I was able to go down to the set, actually see what the actual rooms that we were going to be shooting in looked like. And then I was able to go back into the script and really tighten up the script and make it so that the scenes were written specifically for this location. And that's going to have a lot of advantages when they actually start shooting. I understand that a lot of it takes place in this one big room. I understand the space. I understand sort of where different people will be in this space. There's some closets, there's some hallways, there's some other rooms, and I could write all that stuff in. And not only is it going to make it easier, but I'm able to really maximize what I'm able to use, because there was a desk over here, or there's a little, you know, a little bunch of seats, chairs over here. I was able to really see how the corners worked, and I was able to write that into the script. So I'm able to maximize the production value. They're able to use every square inch of this room because I was able to see it and actually write it in. And the same thing for the rest of this set. It's a big warehouse down in downtown LA that they've converted into a movie set. And the main downstairs, and this is where this movie takes place, is downstairs in a hospital. So they've got this very elaborate hospital set with patient rooms and an operating room and waiting rooms and a pharmacy, hallways, just a whole bunch of a little nursing area, nursing station, a little place with beds, hospital beds, all this stuff, an emergency room, all this stuff they had in the first floor of this big warehouse-like building. Looks really good. So again, I was able to really write that stuff in there. There's a nice staircase. There's an elevator. And these things sound strange. There's a bar set up. So then the upstairs, there's a whole bunch of other rooms. There's a classroom. There's a police station. There's some more offices. There's a locker room. So again, I was able to get a look at these things and write them into the set. There's a nice big lobby. So all this stuff we're able to use once we're renting the building. We can shoot anywhere in this building. So we're able to use every single room. And that just is going to add production value. If I hadn't gotten a look at it, I never would have written this police station into the set. But they had a whole big room, like one of those police rooms, sort of police operating rooms where all the police guys are sitting at their desks working on computers. I had a whole big setup, looks pretty good, and I was able to write that in. But I never would have written that in because if I hadn't actually seen it, because it would have been like, gee, we're going to have to go find this set. But knowing what sets we had access to, then I can go back into the script and really tailor it to what we have. And a good example of that is there's a funeral scene, and I had written it outside at like a cemetery, but inside this room, inside this building, they had like a coffin. I'm sitting there thinking, well, actually, we could convert one of these rooms into an interior of a funeral home instead of the exterior of a cemetery. So it'll just save production a lot of money. They're not going to have to go take the whole crew, go to a cemetery, shoot a scene. They're going to be able to shoot it in this thing. Everything is going to be shot there. There's a bunch of scenes out in the parking lot. I got a good sense of that space. So all that stuff is great. And if you're writing a low budget feature film, really doing that, thinking about where you're actually going to shoot this thing and writing for a specific location is very, very important. A movie I wrote a couple years ago called Ninja Apocalypse did the same thing. The producers knew the location they were going to be shooting at, so we knew what production sets we had, and again, we wrote all of those into the scripts, and it gives the movie a much bigger feel, a much more production value, because you've got all these different sets. Nobody that's watching the movie is going to think all of these different, completely different sets would exist in one building, but they do because it's specifically set up for that. So then after we were on the set, I was there with the director. We went to lunch. We had a nice long meeting about the script. He gave me some good notes. So that's what I've spent this past weekend, really. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That's what I've spent the last few days, just going back over the script. As I said, tweaking it for specific production elements and incorporating the director's notes. I sent him a new draft late last night. So hopefully he's ready to go. We'll see. He seems to be getting the production moving. It seems to be moving forward pretty well. So I'm very hopeful that this thing will get into production soon. Also, if you listen to this podcast regularly, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that I was meeting with some distributors. I was really, from my perspective, I was meeting these distributors to try and talk about my own film that I'm producing, but they wanted to talk to me about some of the things that they're working on, which is fine. So they had a couple of ideas that they were kind of bouncing around. We got to talking, and they called me last week, and I'm going to go meet with them again tomorrow to specifically talk about one project that they want me to write on. Sounds like we're pretty much ready to go. I still have the contract, still needs to be signed and this kind of thing. They need the script pretty quickly. I don't have to write it in a week, but they need the script in about a month. It's the middle of September now, and they need it in the middle of October. So it's going to be quite a good clip to write another feature film script. And as I said, I'm still doing rewrites on this other one, but that I hope that's going to sort of taper off this week, and then I can ramp up into this other script for a month. So that's what I'm working on now, is these two writing assignments. Anyways, let's get into the main segment. Today I'm interviewing Lee Jessup. Here is the interview. Welcome, Lee, to the Selling Your Screenplay podcast. I appreciate your coming back on and talking with me again.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
So we talked originally, I guess it's now been a year and a half. It was episode number 14. I asked you a lot of questions about sort of your beginning career in the screenwriting space. So if anybody is interested in that, we'll refer them to episode 14. And then today we're going to dig into some new stuff.
What episode number is this?
This is, it's a good question, probably around 90-ish, something like that. Yeah. Yeah, we're pushing close to 100. Yeah. So when I record the episodes, it's a couple weeks out before, so I honestly don't know quite what the episode number will be. But I think published, it's like we're on 86, so by the time this goes out, it'll probably be about 90. So you recently wrote a book called Getting It Right, and I wonder if you can start out by just sort of pitching that book and telling us what that book is all about.
The book is really meant to be a practical guide into the business side of a screenwriter's career. I felt that there wasn't enough information from the very, very basic, answering questions, building up a portfolio, body of work, all that, all the way through to contractual stuff, partnerships, et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted to deliver some digestible information to writers, hopefully to get some answers questions, some basic answers questions, arm the writer with information and understanding of this business and how does it work, with the good news and the bad news. I had, certainly went toe-to-toe with my publisher about wanting to keep it honest, wanting to keep it realistic, not wanting to make any false promises about how easy it is. And luckily for me, they're very respectful of that. So they allowed me to write kind of the honest perspective that I have on what it takes to become a working screenwriter.
Yeah. No, it's a very unique book. As I said in the email I sent you, I've never read anything quite like it. So it's a good primer for anybody who's thinking about getting into the space. I mean, there's a ton of books about how to write your screenplay, and this is a very unique book about really sort of the nuts and bolts business stuff that you would have no way of knowing it. If you didn't work in the business, you really would have no way of knowing this stuff, and it's definitely good to get up on that. So let's talk about just some of the things. As I was reading the book, I wrote down some questions. So one of the things that came up, you mentioned a variety of online services for screenwriting, really from soup to nuts. And at one point you sort of call them, I think you even call them qualified services. And we don't necessarily have to get into like the specifics of what services are, you know, so-called qualified. But I get this question all the time is, you know, hey, is this service any good? Is this service, you know, worth doing? And so how would you sort of arm a screenwriter just in a generic sense if they're wondering, hey, should I check out this service? What should they be looking for and what should they do to figure out if that is a reputable service or a service, not even reputable, but a service that might potentially help them?
Well, I think, first of all, because the help space for screenwriters is so overly saturated, right? And, you know, I ran ScriptArt for 6.5 years, and one of the luxuries that I had while I was doing that is that I was financed by the New York Times, and so I was allowed to do a lot of market research, and I would sit back and watch the numbers grow. How many coverage services are out there? How many consultation services are out there? And it just grew year over year as the industry retracted following the recession, all of those things. So I think it's really important for writers to really figure out what works, what doesn't work, what's worth their money. You know, I always crowdsource my information. So I always go to my writers, and I'm lucky to have an army of writers that I work with that I can go back to and say, okay, have you worked with this person? What was that experience like? Not everybody has that. You know, what I will offer out is that I have a resource guide that is kind of built off of what I started in the book, but has been updated year over year. So if anybody wants that, feel free to email me, lee@leejessup.com. I'm more than happy to send it out. So I keep that for myself for reference. But really do your research. I find Twitter to be a great resource. I find ScriptMag to be a great resource. More than, you know, finding one review or one off, which is not really what you're looking for. You want to see what is that person's or service's footprint in the industry. Are they active? Are they present? Are people engaging with them? Is there general feedback that people are getting? Can you connect with somebody that they're working with? For example, one of my writers was just offered entry into a program that is supposedly started by a number of managers. So he found a way to contact other writers who participated in that program to sit down and say, okay, what is your experience? Truly, was it good? Was it bad? It's really important to do that research because there's just, you can start spending money today and not stop until you're utterly broke. So it's really important to do comprehensive research, never go off of one thing, but rather see if you can create a composite of information to inform your opinion and your decision.
Yeah, for sure. That's sound advice. So one of the other things you talk about in your team is, or in your book, is about writing teams and sort of the team that a writer would assemble. And I wonder if you can talk about, first off, what that writing team looks like, and then we'll kind of get into maybe how to actually assemble that team. But what kind of a team does a writer need as they progress in their career?
Well, the thought behind that particular perspective is that in any other skill-based profession, where one has to continue to improve and the rewards are, if success is achieved, immense, there's a support team in place. If you're a tennis player, if you're a chef, if you are an architect, there are mentors, there are guides, there are teachers. There's, you know, in really every scenario, and somehow we don't seem to have developed that philosophy quite as well in the entertainment space, even though actors certainly have their coaches and their teachers and their mentors. So for me, a writer should always have a story consultant or story analyst, somebody who is more advanced than they are, somebody who is really understands story, is a proven voice in that space, who will always be able to give them sound, reasonable, vetted advice, understand what they're trying to do, et cetera. I'm a big believer in classes, so teachers become part of that team, people that you can refer to later. Your community can become part of that team if they're writers who are ahead of you. in their careers who can support you, people like me to become support, because we are there to provide information, supports, insight, guidance, all of those things. And all of that can hopefully keep the writer going, because ultimately this is not a sprint. Getting a career going is 3 to 5 years at minimum. Most people will say it's 5 to 10. So you really have to figure out how to survive on year 7 and be prolific and have then be motivated and be consistent and be executing, as opposed to how to get through the first 6 months. Anybody can get through the first 6 months. I promise that. But once rejections start rolling in and disappointment and challenges and changes in the industry, who do you turn to? How do you keep yourself going?
Yeah, yeah. And so where does like an agent and a manager fall into that part of that team? At what point do you recommend that?
Well, agents or managers will come in at a later date. Before 2008, we saw a time where managers really stepped in at an early stage to this, and they're in developing managers. They spent a lot of time developing their clients, doing creative development. Because of the changes in the industry, we're not seeing that quite so much anymore. And managers are looking for writers with at least more complete work. It's very rarely anymore, oh, I like the voice, let me see what we can develop for that voice. They're really looking to see it on the page. And very few managers have the bandwidth to really develop new talent without any success stories or wins under the talent's belt. Certainly they come in later, but to me, agents and managers are effectively the writer's clients that the writer has to satisfy. And with them being the writer's clients, the writer has to keep some sort of a professional facade, a professional face on, in order to keep the relationship steady and powerful and effective for the long term. So to me, a manager or an agent is just not the person to have a meltdown with. All writers will have meltdowns. It's not the place to take your crappy ideas that may be gold, but maybe not so much. They're one more client that the writer has to satisfy, ultimately, because the competition is just so high in the space right now. Everybody has a loaded list, every agent or manager that I know anyway. Every writer is competing to get on that agent or manager's list. So those relationships have to be very carefully considered and maintained.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's interesting what you're saying. And I think so many writers have this idea that I just need to get an agent or manager and then things will be gold. And they don't realize that exactly what you just said. Hey, getting some wins under your belt before that actually is a big part of that process. And maybe you can talk to that a little bit. What percentage of sort of your clients or even just the writers you know, sell or option or win or have some big successes before they get an agent manager? Because I think most people that come into this, they think the first step is getting an agent manager. But what percentage would you say actually sell something before they get an agent manager?
Well, I wouldn't say they necessarily sell something before an agent or manager, but definitely there's, for the majority, I mean, I have one writer who just got signed who literally didn't have one success story to his name. And it was a very scary moment because you get a writer out with a great script and you go, yeah, I really hope that, you know, that everybody will be willing to overlook. And the material was strong enough for that, but I know how rare that is. My writers who get signed, all other than the one, all have some pedigree to them. So television fellowships, odd jobs. I have one writer who ghostwrites for A-list directors in this town. So there is some recognition there and there is some relationships there. It doesn't necessarily have to go all the way to that sale, but we are looking for that contest win or contest placement. One of my clients just placed top 5 in tracking VM from that data manager. We're really looking for those sorts of success stories in order to get the writer out there. And, you know, we really are in a place where what writers don't understand is that you get an agent, you get a manager, and I'm a big believer in managers for baby writers. I'm not a big believer in agents. Not that I don't believe in them as people just for that stage of the career. What most people don't understand is you get the manager, the clock starts ticking. This is the time when you're going to have to work the hardest. When you've got them on one script, you're going to have to create the other script. You're going to have to prep for meetings. You're going to have to continue to impress. I have 2 clients with the same manager. One is delivering every 6 months, reinventing himself, delivering really fantastic work. The manager is thrilled, but he's working hard at this. And the manager doesn't see the hard work, right? The manager only sees the result. He doesn't see the conversations about ideas and concept development and outlines that had to be rewritten from scratch and episodes that pilot episodes that have to be thrown out in order to create new ones. He just sees the work, the stellar work. He knows this writer is always prepped for meetings. The other writer has been struggling with the writing, has been feeling a lot of pressure since the first script that got him out to some managers. And it's been, I think, about 13 months now since the manager sent something out on his behalf. And the truth of the matter is the manager is now not reading the work with the same priority. Now, when this writer sends in work, he read something else a while ago, didn't like it that much. Now he's probably a month out from reading a new draft from his writer because he has to prioritize his clients.
Yeah. And I wonder, just again, just sort of casually with the numbers, again, I just feel like a lot of people feel like, hey, once I get the agent manager, it's all smooth sailing. And how many people do you see, they get that first agent manager, and you just said the clock is ticking, you've got to impress, you've got to keep, and how many people kind of reach that level, but then end up having to take a step back where their agent manager actually drops them, and they kind of have to start from scratch?
I would say, sadly, and this is collected from a lot of information I get from writers who come to me after the fact, but I would say there's about 30 to 40% of writers who get signed, get some height, and then get dropped fairly quickly. Within a year, 2 years, you know, there's just radio silence from the reps, then they end up sending something in, there's no response, and then 6 months later you get the call. I'm cleaning my list, it's that time, I really have to focus on my other talent, yada yada, I don't think it's the right fit. You've heard of those conversations.
Yeah. So another question that kind of, and this leads into, my next question kind of leads into what we're talking about here. And I get these emails a lot, and so I'll be curious to hear your take on it. When is it time to just pack it in and quit? At what point do you tell a writer, you know, maybe this isn't the right career choice for you? Is there ever a good time, or is there ever a point at which you recommend that?
When they don't want to do it anymore. I mean, it sounds really simplistic, but I know when I'm sitting down with a writer who's just disgruntled and bitter and pissed off, and, you know, I usually know the flip side. I've seen them happy. And the bottom line is they don't want to do it anymore, or they're making every excuse in the book why they can't do it or haven't done it or haven't been producing. You know, I had a conversation last week with a writer who swears that she really wants to write and working really hard and is a very talented writer in her own right, but just not finding the time for it. And we had to have a conversation of, do you really actually want to write? Do you like the idea of your name up in lights? Or do you like the idea of sitting down day in, day out, sleep deprived, tired from your full-time job and doing this because that's what it takes? You know, those are the times where those conversations come up. And I do, because I look at writer behavior as part of my job, I look at how much writers are saying they want to write, what their dreams and aspirations are, but also what they're doing in practicality. And practicality, they are not producing, they're not writing, they're not prioritizing the writing, then it's probably time to consider something else.
Okay, and is it time maybe just for a break or time for a totally...
I don't think in breaks.
No, okay.
I've worked with writers who sold material, had material produced, big titles, who got disgruntled, left the industry, you know, 5 years, 6 years, 8 years. Coming back is, man, I mean, that's starting Everest back in India. I mean, it's really... It's such a trek to come back, and there is that prevalent industry question. You had all the success. What happened? Have you been in a coma? If the answer is no, then you're just not going to be taken as seriously. So I don't – like, you want to go take a vacation, go away for a month, sit in the Bahamas on the beach, chill out, drink martinis, go nuts. But taking a break, I don't believe in. I know it sounds really, you know, work campish. I get that. Mm-hmm. But I see what happens when a break is repaired, and it's so difficult. And most writers would never really truly come back.
Yeah, yeah. So I wonder if you ever run into clients that, like you're just basically saying, well, if they're not enjoying the work, then maybe it's time to reconsider. But do you ever find clients that they seem to be enjoying the work and doing the work and producing pages, but you look at it and say, I just don't know that this person has the talent to ever succeed? Do you ever find yourself in a position? And I get a lot of these, you know, people just sending me random scripts and this, and it's like, I just sometimes wonder if there isn't some God-given talent that you need. And some people, they like the writing, but maybe this isn't really a career for them.
Well, I've certainly, people have come to me with a, somebody came to me with a specific script and said, can I be a huge Hollywood success? And I always say, I can't judge your future or your future works, but based on what I'm seeing in front of me, if we want to go that route, it's going to take a lot of work. You know, I do believe that there is learning involved, and a very, very important aspect of screenwriting is being challenged, learning, taking classes, finding people that will challenge your work and you get better over time. There's definitely people who haven't produced that work yet. I will never say there's no chance in hell that you'll get there, because that's really not for me to say. That's not for me to judge. It's for me to give them the direction into what will help them. But, you know, just 2 weeks ago, somebody wanted to come work with me and sent me a script, and I ended up emailing him in the middle of the night after reading the script and saying, I want to refund you your money because you're in no place to discuss your career. You need to work with a script consultant. You need to figure out screenwriting basics before we can even have any sort of non-theoretical conversation. And I felt that it was a disservice to him taking his money, because clearly he didn't need me, and any thought that he needed somebody to talk to about career and how to build a career was entirely aspirational, because the skill set wasn't there. I do want to just hit on one thing. We talk about enjoying the work, and I think it's important to make the distinction between enjoying the day-to-day of the work, because writers who have days that they hate the writing, and for me, it's you hate every job at moments, but hopefully you love the job, which is the writing, more than you hate the job. And so long as you love the job more than you hate the job, then you should keep at it. When you get to a place where it's making you miserable and you hate the job all the time, that's when go work at Starbucks. You'll be happier.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this. One of the things that I've been wondering myself, and I, as I do the podcast now, as I said, we're almost up to 100 episodes, I've kind of gone back and looked at the screenwriters that I've interviewed, and I've had some Doug Richardson, who wrote Die Hard 2, and John Jarrell, and I look back at Mark Lawrence, who wrote Miss Congeniality. I've had some pretty big screenwriters on, and one of the things that I would say seems to be like you talk about doing the work and this kind of thing, and I have no doubt that these people all worked incredibly hard, but it seems like most of the most successful screenwriters, they didn't have just years and years of toiling and you know, yeah, maybe there was a year or two, but they pretty much broke in and had some success and at least got their career going. And John Jarrell, I interviewed him extensively, and I would say he's maybe the one exception. Now, I had a very long interview with him, and maybe he's just more honest about it, but he had like 7 years of real struggle living in a 400-square-foot apartment down in Venice for, you know, $700 a month, and there were really some lean times for him. But other than that, like as I said, Mark Lawrence, I interviewed him. I mean, it just, there wasn't years and years of struggle. Doug Richardson, there wasn't years and years of struggle. And so I wonder if I don't know. I mean, maybe those guys just have a lot of talent and they're able to break in because they've got the talent. And so where does that play into it? And I'd be curious just to hear, you've seen a lot of screenwriters that have had successful, and just kind of get your opinion on how people fit in and how much toil the successful people have.
First of all, I mean, there are a few different things to discuss here. One is that the industry has changed aggressively in the last 10 years. Forget the 90s, where material was moving like hotcakes and people were selling stuff and selling concepts. And, you know, it was a free-for-all. I mean, Jewel Roth got on a desk and within 2 weeks sold a script. Where in the world does that happen now? That doesn't exist in our industry anymore. So the industry has changed. If you look at Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, they came out of USC and instantly sold the script. We don't hear those stories anymore, and if we do, they're outliers. The second thing is that it's really easy to romanticize how it happens. Melissa Hilfers wrote a script and sold it called Undone. Earlier this year, it sold in March. It was a spec sale. And there were comments in the Deadline article about the script sale about how she was a litigator in New York. And, oh, she just, you know, somebody made a comment, oh, she just wrote the script on the side and sold it. I have to call bullshit. I know Melissa. Melissa worked her ass off. She's the hardest working person I know. Always reaching out to the industry and creating new stuff. She wrote the script in 3 months. But this was not her first or second script. She worked her butt off, but there was this really fun idea of like, oh, there's this litigator who, you know, at night after she's done in court, goes home, writes the script, and sells it. That's not the story, and that's not the reality. So the writers that I see with success that break today or break in the last 5 years, there's work. Everybody loves the story about the insurance agent who, you know, wrote a script from his desk while rolling calls. But ultimately, those stories don't happen a lot. And I do find that for people breaking and working today, which is really my audience and my people, my writers, it is a lot of work. There isn't that magic formula. There, you know, and there's that moment when you're really hot where it feels like anybody will buy anything, and then a drop of a hat, something in the wind changes, and you have to work again. And so it is a working profession, a hardworking profession. The writers who are on the studio list, which are very few writers, have a different life and a different game, but they broke a while ago. They've been on those lists for 10 years, 12 years, and they're getting those jobs left, right, and center, and they're getting into pitch, and oftentimes they are selling pitches. But those are not writers who are breaking today or trying to break today.
Are we talking, like, and using this woman who you just mentioned who sold the spec, are we talking 2 to 3 years of you know, hard work, or are we talking 5 to 10 years of hard work? Because I think there's a big differential. I think there's, like, especially when I moved out to Hollywood, I got here, and there's that sort of 2 or 3 year period where, as you said, almost anybody can make it through sort of that period. But that, once you hit that 2 to 3 year period, I had a lot of friends that had shown up in Hollywood the same time I did. After 2 or 3 years, they start to drift away, and those people that don't make it. So that's, there seems to be sort of a point. So there's a difference between 2 and 3 years and 5 and 10 years. And I'd be curious to see where what you're talking about.
I believe 3 or 4. I think it was closer to 4 because I met her about 2 years into the journey. So we're talking 4 to 5 right now, I believe. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. So, Melissa, if you're hearing this and I'm wrong, I'm sorry. But, you know, this is also a person who wasn't litigating anymore. She was a person who was writing full time. You know, this is not something that she did at night when the muse struck her. So the hours, if you look at the sheer hours that she put into her writing, I guarantee you they would compete anybody else's hours who's working a full-time job and working at it for 10 years. So there is, I agree with you that there are people who show up with a lot of intention and a lot of motivation right out the gate and then drift off. And that's where, you know, Michael Hagel always says, this is a game of tenacity. And you know what? I get it. And that's where my point of view comes in, which is it's a marathon. You have to train for the marathon. You have to treat it as a marathon. You have to expect the marathon. Miracles don't happen. I have one writer who broke in 6 months. He went to Great American Pitch Fest a few years ago. He pitched to somebody who ultimately didn't like his work, but like liked his voice. It was The Asylum. He ended up getting an assignment from them to do a movie. The movie was shot 6 months later. And when that happened, I had to sit down with him and say, just so you know, it's going to get much tougher for you. Because that's how this world works. This is an outlier. This is an exceptional story. And things did get tougher. Of course, he's writing more movies for The Asylum now. He's having great success. He's working casting over there as well. But this was an outlier, and he knew it, and I knew it. And you know, we had to kind of take that in and still prepare for hard work and tough battles that he had to fight.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the things I thought might be interesting, you kind of talk about career coaching, you know, writers of all different levels. So I thought it might be interesting just to run through some of the different levels and maybe talk about some of the common problems that someone at this level is making, and then potentially some fixes for those people that are at that level. So let's start out with, you know, beginning writers. What are some of the mistakes that you see beginning writers make, and what are some of the things that they could do to shore those mistakes up?
The first mistake is always, I wrote a script. My first script, it's the first draft of my first script, and it's so great, and I'm going to send it out. I'm going to get it to an executive, and it's going to get made. A lot of first-time writers don't understand the process, don't understand the importance of rewriting, don't understand the importance of early and often exposure of the work. the importance of a really good idea behind the work, as opposed to just, oh, it happened to my mother, so I thought I'd write about it, because it's always been in my heart and it's meant something. So really picking your ideas, vetting the work, getting into writers' groups, getting, you know, finding a mentor, a consultant, a reader, somebody that you can work with, that you trust, that has a great reputation, a class that you can get into, to really make the work as strong as possible. Because a lot of writers, and this has happened to me for years, well, I'll talk to a writer and they'll say, oh, I have a script, I need an agent. And I'll say, well, how's the script? Well, it's okay, it's pretty good, but I need an agent because I'm a writer and I'm so brilliant. And the important thing for first-time writers, new writers, to remember is that what's on the page has to match what you believe you are as a writer. There is no, I'm a great writer, but on the page, it's okay. It really has to be great. So that's a big thing, reading a lot of scripts, understanding how this industry works. I have writers, for first-time writers, will come to me and say, I wrote an animation script, and I want to sell it. And then you have to go into the conversation of why you can't sell an animation script in Hollywood, because they're all developed in-house. And when it happens very rarely. So you have to understand this machine that you're trying to become a part of. It's never too early to start reading industry news. It's never too early to start reading screenwriting blogs, commentary, all that sort of stuff, to understand what is that living, breathing, ever-changing industry that you're trying to break into.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's progress one step further and talk about some of the mistakes that writers, maybe they've won a contest, maybe they've optioned something, maybe they've somehow got an agent, but they haven't quite sold something yet. So, but they're definitely past those sort of beginning stages. What are some of the mistakes you see them making, and what are some of the things they could do to fix those mistakes?
Well, we talked about, or you mentioned a few different types of writers here, so let's break it down a little bit. With contest scripts, Shelley Malott at Final Draft, who's a good friend, I'm a coach over there for the Final Draft contest winners, always sits me down and says to me, can you explain to them the difference between a contest script and the real script? And so we have to have a conversation about understanding that a script that can win a contest oftentimes is not judged by the same criteria as a script itself. It's that simple. It's, you read for different reasons. You read without considering budget, without considering audience marketability, without considering the international market, without considering a whole slew of things that come into consideration when purchasing the script. So writers always have to really consider whether their contest script is also commercially viable, market viable, and if not, start working towards that one. Writer with an agent, writer that maybe got an option, there's a slew of mistakes there. To me, the biggest mistake is not starting on your next great script right away. Having that next piece, you know, you get a manager, you get out there, you get some generals. You get the generals on the merit of the script that got you in the door, right? Everybody likes the writing, let's meet the writer. And most likely, it doesn't always end up with a purchase. They want to know what's the next thing that you have. What's your new shiny toy that everybody's going to be really excited about? Talk to me about that. The writers that don't have that to talk about do themselves a real huge disservice. You know, I have a writer right now who's out in generals on one pilot, and it just so happens that he happens to be finishing another pilot that's a month out. So he's already pitching the next thing and getting his fan base really excited about it so that he can deliver the next thing to people that are eager to see his work. You know, the last thing that I'll mention, well, two more things I'll mention here. One is the wrong measure for success. A lot of writers talk about, I'll succeed when I sell that spec for $1 million. First of all, specs don't sell for $1 million in today's industry very often at all. Secondly, not a lot of specs are selling. So how do you measure success? You have to measure success by general meetings, by assignments, by being put up by your rep to go after jobs. As opposed to just selling that one individual spec. We're going to be selling less than 100 specs this year. So selling a spec cannot be the measurement of success for a writer. We have more than 3,000 working writers. Does that mean that those three, you know, whatever it is, 2,920 writers have all failed? No, they're working. They're getting paid. So it's finding the correct industry-appropriate measurement for success as opposed to the outside of the industry measurement for success, which is when are you going to win your Academy Award? Or when are you going to write that blockbuster? The last kind of bit of mistake that I see out there oftentimes, and clearly there's many more, but I'm just trying to pick the highlights for you, are writers who write a script, get an agent, get a manager, and then just sit on their hands. I did my job, you do it now. And, you know, one agent said to me years ago, Brent Rose, said, you know, I get 10% of the money and therefore I'm doing 10% of the work. And that's it. And the reality of building a career, that takes a lot more than 10%. In this climate, we're talking about 20, 30, 40%. So you have to be writing your next work. You have to be taking responsibility for networking, for meeting people, for getting connections, for getting out there. So expecting the agent or manager to kind of take the whole thing and run with it is a very wrong expectation. And that's where we go back to what we talked about earlier, writers getting dropped.
Yeah, yeah. I want to just talk about one thing that you kind of just mentioned. There's a very humorous story in your book about a writer who won a contest, and then like 2 years later, he got back to you and said, okay, I'm ready. So one, and that's obviously a thing. That's a clear example of what not to do. Yeah. But maybe we can talk about what realistically, if someone wins one of the bigger contests, mm-hmm. you know, what should they do and what can they really expect? Again, I get these emails and it's exactly what you're talking about. People think they're going to win. I mean, even the Nichols Fellowship, you go and look at the list of the scripts that have won that, you know, most of them have not actually made it into production, and that's the top of the key. So what can people realistically expect, and what can they do? What should and could they do with even a quarterfinals in the Nichols or a finalist in one of these bigger contests?
Well, I think you're speaking to something very true that's happening out there. I'm going to win a contest, and then it's all going to fall in my lap. Whether the organizers do it for me or the script does it for me or whatever it is, it's just going to come to me. Really, for me, contests are all about pedigree. They're all about creating some differentiator for your script. Here's why you should read my script and not the other 100 that are sitting in your queue right now. But that means that you have to get your script out there. That means that you have to utilize every win as a bit of credibility to get in front of people, to say to people, I got an 8 on the blacklist. I was a finalist in Nickel. I was top 3 in final draft. So you really have to use that win, first of all, rather than wait for the organizers or facilitators to get the material out there. I work with the winners of the Faden contest from last year, and they wrote a great script, period piece, and they kind of took it and ran with it. And that's exactly what you should do. They didn't rely on the contest organizers to do all the legwork for them. Every contest is going to do a little bit of legwork because ultimately – getting your script out there, getting signed, and on the occasion of getting material discovered, picked up, like Matriarch that happened through Launchpad, or Bethlehem that happened through Final Draft, or Extent that happened through Cassidy. Of course, that gives the contest credibility. It makes it more relevant for the industry. But the organizers also know that it's not going to happen every time out. So they're going to do what they can, but then they're going to move on to their next contest, to their next effort. And it's really up to you, the contest winner or the contest placer, to take that and run with it and make the most with it. It's also for you to understand whether your script that you love, that you toiled over, is a contest script or whether it's a market-viable script. Evan Doherty won the Script Pipeline contest and went on to write Snow White and the Huntsman. He was discovered through that, but ultimately he was just discovered that way. It was then that he hooked up with a manager who was excited about him, who positioned him for other success. But it wasn't that contest script. So you have to figure out whether that contest script is enough to not just attract you attention, but to be a viable market sample. You know, I'll see scripts with, you know, those things that, you know, just are never going to happen in real life, you know, so far as material getting picked up. Screenplays that are all, you know, 8-year-old kids that get really far in a contest. It's a great script. It's a fun writing sample, but it's not going to get made. You know, especially not when there's building exploding behind them, because it's just not a wise investment. It's still a stellar contest script. But you have to figure out whether your contest script is market viable. And if not, what is that next idea that will be, and be really ready to talk about that as soon as you win that contest or as soon as you get that placement. Mm-hmm. So that's really, really important stuff.
And just to clarify, you say basically you're hoping to win the contest, build your pedigree. And what exactly does that mean? Does it mean query letters? Does it mean cold calls? So then when you are cold calling a production company, you can say, I just won this contest. What exactly are those marketing channels that these writers should be using? Just all Inktip, Blacklist, all the above?
As many as they can find that are proven avenues into the industry. So I believe in targeted queries, reaching out to people that you're a huge fan of, managers that you've heard speak on, for example, your podcast, and saying, I heard you speak on Ashley's podcast. Can you, please read my script? It just was a finalist in Page, and I loved what you said. That's pedigree right there. This is not just a nothing writer, yet another, and I don't mean to say that in any sort of disparaging way, but a writer that doesn't have any credibility, that I don't have any way of telling whether it's good or it's bad. I'm going to, if I say yes to reading a script, they're going to hound me. They're going to call me. They're going to email me. They're going to bother me until I read the script. If it's a really bad script, do I want to have that conversation? Do I have to then avoid them? So agents and managers are looking, specifically agents and managers, but sometimes producers as well, are looking for those effectively sign-offs. They utilize contests and the blacklist and Spec Scout, which is Scoggins' service, as vetting services to identify good material. We're seeing roughly 60,000 scripts getting registered with the WGA every year. How do you find the really great 500? That's the question. Or, let's say 5,000 of those are pro scripts. We're still talking about 55,000 scripts that you would potentially have to sift through. How do you find the stuff? So there are all of these particular roadblocks that have been placed there by the industry, so that a contest win or a good score from the blacklist, all of those can be used in a targeted query, can be used in a pitch event, can be used in virtual pitch fest or production art services or any one of those channels to say, look at me, I got an 8, I'm a finalist in this big contest, and really only big contests matter. Small contests really don't have that kind of pedigree. Then you use every available avenue.
Okay, so let's move along to writers that are maybe a little more seasoned. Maybe they've sold a bunch of stuff, and I would put myself in this category. I've sold a half dozen feature scripts, optioned lots more, but I still feel like I'm a long ways from being a studio screenwriter. So maybe you could give some advice to people that are sort of my boat. And I get a lot of people coming through my site that they have sold some stuff and they actually do have some credentials. But again, there's a big gap between selling a half dozen scripts, as I know, and actually selling something at that studio level. So maybe you can give some advice to people like myself.
Well, the first thing for me is that a lot of writers who've had some success have a tendency to let their network go stale. So they met somebody at a party 2 years ago, but they never connected. Little do you know, this could be the somebody that can help you migrate to that next level. So it's really important to keep taking care of those industry contacts. My writers are on a schedule. We have Excel spreadsheets. They know where they're when they had coffee last, when they reached out last. They're saying that effective networking is done in the spirit of generosity. So I like to see my working writers specifically, but this is across the board, networking and making it about the other person. Let me buy you coffee. Let me buy you lunch. Let me ask you some questions rather than I read a script. Can you read it? Can you help me? I'm trying to get a new agent. I'm trying to get a new manager. I'm trying to get to blah, blah, blah. Do you happen to know them? When networking is done in the spirit of generosity, then opportunities are offered back up to you. So it's incredibly important to keep your network primed, to constantly keep in touch with everybody that you know so that you don't reach back out to them 5 years later when you found out that they went from, a lowly kind of lifetime executive to run Warner Brothers TV. You want to stay in touch. People in this industry move so fast. And when I was coming up 20 years ago in this industry, the joke was always be nice to the root assistant at CAA because one day he'll be running a studio. And that's absolutely the truth. Be nice to everybody. Keep in touch with everybody. Go have coffee with the assistant. You just don't know how it's going to happen. And the important thing is to constantly reinvent yourself on the page. Constantly challenge yourself. Don't repeat what you did before because you already did that. You already had success with that. And the biggest thing that people watch for with repeat writers is, are they doing the same thing all over again? Now it's a Western, but it's the same story as it was in space. So it really is about reinventing yourself and finding ways to be challenged. you know, I find that people who are selling need to be on top of what, you know, what's on the screen, what's on the page, that much more so than anybody else, because that's the expectation of you. You earned your A. Now you have to keep your A. So you really have to stay on your game.
I one of the things I wonder, and that's all sound advice, and I appreciate that. One of the things I wonder, and again, I'd be curious to get your thoughts on this, is now that I've sold a bunch of scripts, and these scripts, these movies have been made, I wonder if there's not some, like now it's like, a bunch of these movies have been made, and none of them have been particularly good. So I almost wonder if that doesn't hinder me a little bit, is people kind of figure, well, I've had my shot, and you're talking about reinventing yourself. Maybe that means just writing stuff that's completely outside of sort of the genre of what I've actually had success with. I don't,
sometimes it's writing outside of your brand. You know, because you've already established in some way, you know, how to put words on paper that end up on screen. If you feel like you've gone as far as you can go, sometimes it's stepping outside of your brand. Sometimes it's learning to have those tough conversations with representation that a lot of writers really don't want to have. How do I get on that studio list? How do I get onto a lot? How do I start meeting with those executives just as a general introductory kind of stuff? A lot of writers don't want to push because they're afraid, specifically if they've sold some stuff but they haven't made it into, you know, the kind of big A-listy, you know, $30,000, $40,000 a week for assignments, yada, yada. How to have those conversations without pissing representation off. A lot of times it's about doing that with TV, with my clients in TV. It's a lot of holding up and saying, yes, I have opportunities to staff or to go in as a story editor or then to go in as a co-producer, but, you know, I'm going to hold up. I'm going to reject all those opportunities, and I'm going to potentially not staff for a year, but I'm going to wait to go to a co-EP level. You know, it really is about making the brave decisions, not the easy decisions.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think just having a large number of mediocre credits, though, do you think that ever becomes just a detriment? I mean, I've had people, it's like, I don't need another crappy credit on my resume. And I've had some people recently that said, you know, they offer me something for a script, and it's like, I'm looking at them thinking, you know, they're going to make another mediocre movie. Do I really need that on my resume? Do you think that's ever a hindrance? Or, I mean, Michael Caine had some famous saying about acting, you know, it's like, people forget the bad movies, it's just being everything. And he's kind of proven that. I think there's something to that. But I don't know.
Yeah. But the reality is that for every Michael Caine or every Johnny Depp, that people forget that he was in the Nick of Time and, you know, a bunch of kind of neither here nor there movies. For every one of those, they're actors that were almost there and didn't make it. And I think it's very easy to say those things when you bridge the gap, when you made that leap. But I think that at some point you start being labeled, and we do this everywhere and everything. You know, it's just human nature. We want to understand who it is that we're dealing with. So we start labeling based on the information that we have. And I've worked with production companies before. I was like, oh, what about this writer? Well, he's a B-movie writer. We want somebody who's more A-listy or could go that way. So I do think that too many of those inconsistently can hurt you. I can tell you that, you know, I have one writer who wrote for The Asylum. I have another writer. I was like, you're allowed two. You're allowed two Asylum movies. After this, you're an Asylum writer. Like, this is what you do. And not every Asylum writer becomes the writer who wrote Sharknado. You know, so you do have to really consider where you want to hedge your bets.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's move on to working TV writers. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, again, some of the mistakes you see them making and what a actual working writer in television could be doing to move their careers forward.
Well, television, even more so than film, is a world of relationships, right? It's about ingratiating yourself in every possible way with the people that are higher up than you, making those allies, being great in the room, not irritating anybody in the room. You know, and I can tell you that specifically on the, you know, PA level, staff writer level, and sometimes even story editor level, I will hear stories about writers who lost their cool, writers who stepped over the toes of the EP, the co-EP, got rid of the showrunner, with pitches, who, you know, have illusions of grandeur in the room. You really have to figure out where your place is always in the room until you get showrunner. You always have to know your place. There's a real hierarchy in TV, and you have to understand it. You know, you have to have a lot of friends in TV across the board, and you have to also get to a place where you start making a stand for the shows that you want to write on as opposed to the shows that you're being invited to staff on, whether as a co-producer or consulting producer, et cetera. So, you know, at some point you can say, okay, I can be on Law and Order now or a Law and Order type show for the next 10 years. But if I do that, I'm likely never writing on Sons of Anarchy or Masters of Sex or, you know, Bastard Executioner or any type of those kind of more highbrow cable shows. You know, I do see a lot of TV, working TV writers with their network sample, but they really want to work in cable. So you really have to write to your sensibilities, to where you think you're best as opposed to where you think you can be fit in. And not being afraid to take that stand and saying, I'm not going to staff at this level. I'm looking to go the next level on a new show.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's wrap up this section of the interview. Just with talking about studio level writers, what are some mistakes that you see them making, and what can they do to fix those mistakes?
Well, studio. I mean, we have to remember studio level writers are very few and far between. Mm-hmm. But you know where I see those things kind of start to fall apart is where I've known a couple of writers who got a little bit of a god complex. It's my movie. It's my show. I say how it goes. I know better than everybody else. I'm going to call the executive and rip them a new one, and they get off the list. You know, it's very important to remember, no matter where you go, you know, whether you're studio or indie, film is a director's medium. TV is more so of a writer's medium, but, you know, the director is the captain of the ship. And I've seen writers in studio level try to assert themselves the captain. It never worked out. The other thing that happens with studio level writers is that they can price themselves out. And I've seen that happen as well. Kind of the quote keeps going up and up and up that eventually they're hireable on, you know, maybe 3 pictures a year if they're lucky. And at some point they're priced out. It's much, much better to go with somebody who's half the price and still has pedigree and reputation. So you have to be really careful as you're pushing your quote up and allowing your agent to push your quote up, and your agents will push the quote up faster because they anticipate that at some point you'll leave them, as usually happens with agencies. And we certainly see talent and lit hop from agency to agency as kind of the standard. They're going to push the quote up as high as they can because they figure in 2 years it's not going to be their problem. It's going to be somebody else's problem because you will have left because you're not getting those assignments anymore. But they got the big chunk. So you have to be really mindful on what your quote is and is it going up too high to a place where you are just no longer in the market and no longer viable for those studios.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's talk about you're running some online support groups for screenwriters. Let's talk about that for a minute. Maybe you can kind of tell us what those are all about and how people can look and learn more about them.
Sure. I have a big passion about writers' community. I've know for a fact and have seen it throughout my career that writers thrive when they have counterparts, when they have other writers to talk to learn from, when they're hearing the questions that they didn't think to ask, where writing is not just a hobby. You know, it's something that is alive and well for them. I'm involved with a writer's group here in Los Angeles that I've been involved with for years, and I've seen how those writers have grown and evolved and succeeded with each other's support. And so I decided to do an online experiment, really, which is how it started, to see if I can create community for writers who are maybe not in Los Angeles, even though we have some writers who are, to connect them a little bit more to the world of screenwriting. And so we have a private Facebook page. We do monthly online sessions. The writers get to submit their questions. I know writers in the group have exchanged pages, have read for one another. Just today, somebody was coming on saying, hey, I need a new copy of Final Draft. So instantly there was somebody with a discount code and somebody else with, oh, I won Final Draft in a contest. I will pass my voucher on to you. So there's this instant place for writers to turn to with the smallest things, like where do I get my software, all the way to much bigger things, you know, like what happened with the Academy Awards Mickle reviews yesterday. I don't know if you heard about this, but
no, I haven't.
There was a very negative, condescending, and unprofessional review that was posted online from one of the Nickel readers for a contest submission, and there was a whole brouhaha about it online, and so my writers chose to come together and talk a little bit about that and have other people where they knew, they understood where this person was coming from. They have some history. So it creates the safe environment to learn about the industry, to talk about the writing experience, to complain about it when it sucks, to talk about, you know, insecurities. I have an agent. I haven't turned anything in 12 months. What do I do? And really allow writers to go think ahead and think about their current station. So we do these groups once a month. Anybody who's interested is welcome to check it out on my website, leejessup.com. I do offer a free trial because I want people to know what they're walking into. That's the story of my community effort.
Okay. And is there some criteria that you would say is a good fit for this? You just mentioned someone, you know, as an example, someone has an agent but hasn't turned anything in 12 months. Do you prefer writers that have a little bit of experience? Are there newer writers?
We have really writers across the board, from really brand new writers who just want to understand it, writers in Australia, England, France, East Coast, West Coast. Some, you know, a few are a little bit more advanced. One just got a green light on a movie. Another is with an agent manager. Another one just had a TV show that's getting picked up. So we have all different levels, but I think part of the glory of it is that everybody's a little bit different, has a little bit of a different perspective and brings in different questions that allows writers to illuminate areas they didn't think to think about. And it's been a really lovely collaborative community. I couldn't enjoy it more.
Perfect. So I will link to that in the show notes for sure. I always like to end the interviews, just have people, they can talk about, you know, their Twitter handle, their Facebook page, really anything you feel comfortable sharing. Just how can people, you know, contact you? How can people potentially follow what you're up to?
Oh, gosh, there's so many ways. Sometimes I feel like I'm tired of myself, so it's hard to come follow me. I just want to go, Lee, shut up. But now I'm on Twitter. Lee Z. Jessup is my handle. I'm on Facebook. Under Lee Jessup there, I also have a career coaching page. I also have a private group page. You can always reach out to me via email, lee@leejessup.com, my website, leejessup.com. I'm really fairly accessible. It's important to me. I always say that I don't know how to bullshit, because it really doesn't pay off and I have to defend the bullshit. Not a bad idea. So I tend to be pretty open and upfront, to anybody and everybody. So, and I really do love the luxury of my job, which is hanging out with writers all day.
Perfect. So, well, Lee, I appreciate your coming on the show. It was a great interview. Lots of good information. I highly recommend your book. Anybody who's listening to this and kind of wants this very, you know, practical nuts and bolts business advice, that's a great place to start. Just check out your book as well.
Yeah, and thank you for having me on again. You have some really great interview subjects. I'm really impressed that you've recorded so many podcasts since we last spoke, which is really not that long ago. So I couldn't be more impressed.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
A quick plug for the SYS Screenwriting Analysis Service. It's a really economical way to get high-quality professional evaluation of your screenplay. When you buy our 3-pack, you get an evaluation at just $67 per script for feature films and just $55 per script for teleplays. All the readers have professional experience reading for studios, production companies, contests, and agencies. You can read a short bio on each reader on our website, and you can pick the one who you think is the best fit for your script. Turnaround time is usually just a few days, but rarely more than a week. The readers will evaluate your script on 6 key factors: concept, characters, structure, marketability, tone, and overall craft, which includes formatting, spelling, and grammar. Every script will get a grade of pass, consider, or recommend, which should help you roughly understand where your script might rank if you were to submit it to a production company or agency. We provide analysis on features and television scripts, and we also do proofreading. So if you don't want an analysis but would like someone to proofread your script, we offer that now too. We will also look at a treatment or outline and give you the same analysis on it. So if you're looking to vet some of your project ideas, this is a great way to do it. Write up a treatment. We have various different lengths that we'll look at, and then our readers will read those treatments and give you, again, the same sort of professional analysis of that treatment. We will also write a logline and synopsis for you. You can add this service to an analysis. So if you don't want to write your own logline or don't want to write your own synopsis, this is a good way to get that done. I recommend that you do. No one knows your material better than you, but some people have a hard time with this, so that's another service that we're currently offering. As a bonus, if your script gets a recommend from a reader, you get a free email and fax blast to my list of industry contacts. This is the exact same blast service I use myself to promote my own scripts, and it's the same service I sell on the website. It's a great way to get your script into the hands of producers who are looking for material. So if you want a professional evaluation of your screenplay at a very reasonable price, check out www.sellingyourscreenplay.com/consultants. In the next episode of the podcast, I'm going to be interviewing Brian DeLeau and Adam Egypt Mortimer, who wrote a film called Some Kind of Hate. It's a very candid conversation about all the struggles they went through to get this movie made. They wrote a script which they thought was good, low budget, and they got a lot of positive feedback on it, but it was a real battle to get this thing made. And we go into some real details. So if you're considering shooting your own film or just interested about how the process works, keep an eye out for that interview next week. It's a real, as I said, a really candid conversation with these guys about all the struggles that they went through. Anyway, that's the show. Thank you for listening.